Second chapter of the unit is called A Tour of the Cell. We're going to look at... Go ahead. I don't have that memorized, but it's on canvas. We're going to look at the major structures in a cell. The organelles, most of them are organelles, but also the just other structures in the cell. And the opening slide here just shows you where we are in terms of size when we think of cells compared to other things in nature. Now, you have to be careful with this scale because this is a logarithmic scale, just like pH is. So every step is 10 times bigger than the step below it, even though it doesn't look like it. And so, in other words, every step is an order of magnitude increase in size. And so this is an enormous range of sizes, from down from the level of atoms up to the tallest, not even the tallest organisms. 10 meters is still not as tall as trees, some trees. Anyway, cells don't occupy very much of the range, meaning there's a big range in the size of organisms, but really not all that much of a range in size of cells. The reason that that is, I'll get into in a little bit, but it all boils down to the fact that organisms get huge if they do, not by having huge cells, but by having a hell of a lot of cells, all of which are small. And so most cells are invisible to the human eye, which is why we use light microscopy to do them. To get detail of the things inside cells, some of which we're looking at today, takes an even stronger microscope, an electron microscope. But anyway, that just gives you an overview. Let's go on to slide 2 and start looking at cells. Now remember, there's a dichotomy with respect to cell type. What is the dichotomy? Right, there are prokaryotic cells and there are eukaryotic cells. Here we're looking at a prokaryotic cell. A bacterium is a typical example of a prokaryote. And just like any cell, a prokaryotic cell has a plasma membrane. That really defines the cell, whatever kind of cell you're talking about. The reason it's a cell is because there is a boundary between that space and everything else, and that boundary is the plasma membrane. So every cell has a plasma membrane, but typically, a prokaryotic cell, in addition to that plasma membrane, which is the orange layer here, there is a cell wall, just like a plant cell. I mean, it's made of different stuff compared to a plant, but just like the cell wall of a plant cell, it's much thicker and sturdier than the plasma membrane, and it's external to the plasma membrane. Now, some of these structures appear on certain species and not others, so it's kind of a catch-all picture. But you can see that this is an example of a flagellated cell, meaning it has flagella, which is a plural word. Just one would be called a flagellum. And flagella are locomotory devices, meaning they are there for the purpose of propelling the organism through a medium. They move the cell. They act like little whips, basically, that push on the liquid that they're living in to move them forward. There might or might not be these fimbriae that you see pictured here. These are little tiny hair-like appendages that usually, if they are present in a bacterium, they are there for the purpose of allowing it to stick to something, like your tonsil or something like that. Something that it's going to live on. The fact that a bacterium has DNA should not surprise you, because all cells that require proteins, which is virtually all cells, need DNA for the same reason, to stand as codes for how to build proteins. So even though a prokaryotic cell doesn't have a nucleus, which is why it's prokaryotic, it does have DNA. It's just that DNA is not in its own compartment. And I mentioned before, I think, when I first started talking about this, that the region of the cytoplasm, which is the only compartment that a prokaryotic cell has, the region in that cytoplasm where you find the DNA kind of huddled together is the nucleoid. Be careful with that word, because it's not a nucleus. It literally means like a nucleus, but it's not a nucleus because it doesn't have its own membrane. Okay, and you might have a capsule, depends on the species. A capsule is a layer that mostly makes it able to stick to surfaces more easily. Now to three. We're looking at a little piece of the plasma membrane of a cell here. Just a tiny piece. The cell would be enormous in this picture, a bit bigger than the room. But what you see is something I've already told you, which is that the main structural component of any plasma membrane is a collection of phospholipids, which are those amphipathic molecules we talked about, that are arranged in a bilayer with the tails, which are hydrophobic, arranged next to each other, and the heads, which are hydrophilic, arranged so that they are facing either the water outside or the water inside the cell. That's why they form, and that's why life exists. That's why cells came into existence. But a plasma membrane is not purely a phospholipid bilayer. It can't be, because for a cell, whatever type, to remain alive, it has to be able to transport things into and out of the cell. There has to be exchange of materials with the surroundings. And the problem with a pure phospholipid bilayer is that certain things will be able to get through, but certain other things won't be. And some of those things that can't get through are necessary to get through for the cell to remain alive. So a plasma membrane is chiefly phospholipids, but embedded in that phospholipid bilayer are various other things, including these purple things, which are proteins. Now, this is an example of that phrase that I warned you about earlier. These proteins are membrane bound, not membrane bounded, right? Membrane bound means tied to a membrane, part of a membrane, not surrounded by their own membrane, which is what membrane bounded means. And we'll talk a lot more about the membrane itself in its own chapter, but it's in this chapter as well, because every cell has a plasma membrane. That is a major component of a cell. Whether you consider the plasma membrane to be an organelle or not, I guess you could debate with biologists. It's just a word game. Mostly we use the word organelle to refer to the structures inside the cell. Okay, well, let's go to four, and let me try to explain why huge organisms, which we're examples of, by the way, we are much, much bigger than the vast majority of organisms alive, even though there's plenty of stuff much bigger than we are. But let me explain why huge organisms don't have huge cells. I mean, you started out as one cell, of course, right? The zygote. You are now the size of a human adult, but you're not just one cell anymore. You didn't just grow your one cell into a human-sized cell. You can't do that, actually. No organism can make a cell as big, arbitrarily big in all three dimensions. Meaning, if you're going to grow a cell, you can't grow it in X, Y, and Z, or height, width, and depth all at once after a certain limit. There is a constraint, in other words, a limit put on how big cells can grow in all three dimensions. And this slide tries to explain this using simple cubes to represent cells, just to make the math easier to think about. So the constraint, or the limit, that does actually limit the how big cells can grow is called the surface area to volume ratio. Any ratio is just one number divided by another, right? It's a fraction. And so surface area to volume ratio is whatever the value of the surface area is divided by the whatever the value is for the volume of that thing. And so for a simple case, we're going to consider this cube to be a cell. And some cells are roughly cubical, plant cells especially. But anyway, like I said, it just makes the math easier. Now notice that no units are given here because the units don't matter. You can think of the units as being anything you want, millimeters, anything. But this is a 1 by 1 by 1 cube, right? Now, what is the surface area of that? I mean, how do you calculate the surface area of a cube? No, that would be the volume. The surface area is how much surface it has on all of its surface. Well, one face of it has an area of length times width, right, which is 1 times 1 in this case, or 1 square unit. But there are 6 faces, so the overall surface area is 6 square units, which is why the 6 is here, all right? This has a surface area of 6 square units, whatever the units are you use. The volume, on the other hand, is length times width times height. So it's 1 times 1 times 1, which is equal to 1 cubic unit of volume. Okay, that's the one right here. And therefore, the surface area to volume ratio of this cell is 6 divided by 1, which is 6. Okay, now let's grow this cell. This cell, it starts out as 1 by 1 by 1. If we grow it 5 times as big in all 3 dimensions, so 5 times as wide, 5 times as high, 5 times as deep, then you have a 5 by 5 by 5 cube, right? Well, each face now is 5 times 5 square units, or 25, and there are 6 of those. So 6 times 25 is 150 square units of surface area. Whereas the volume is 5 times 5 times 5 cubic units, 125 cubic units of volume. Obviously, those numbers have both gone up. 6 has gone to 150 and 1 has gone to 125. When you grow a cell, both the volume and the surface area get bigger, naturally. But the important mathematical fact is that volume grows more quickly than surface does. You think of a graph of y equals x squared, which would be surface area, right? It's a square function. Just for positive values, that would look like this, right? Half of a parabola. Well, y equals x cubed is steeper. It gets bigger quicker. Right? The whole graph would look like that. And the other half of y equals x squared would look like that. But we only care about the positive values. So as you increase x, y grows for both, but y really grows much faster for volume than it does for surface area. And this has the reason this has biological implications, the reason this puts a limit to how big a cell can be, is that for a cell to remain alive, like I said before, it has to be able to transfer things into and out of it. Well, the bigger the volume gets, the more stuff it needs to get in and out of it. And where does that transfer of materials between it and the environment take place? At the surface, exactly, at the membrane. So if you grow the volume bigger than the surface, eventually you'll get to a point where you don't have enough surface to be able to transfer that much stuff into and out of the cell to service that big volume. And therefore the cell can't live and get bigger. At least it can't get bigger in all 3 dimensions at once. So there are cells in your body, for instance, that are very big in 1 or 2 dimensions. Like, there's a neuron going from your toe all the way to your spinal cord. That's one cell, roughly a meter long, depending on how tall you are. But the other 2 dimensions are microscopically small. So the surface is not a cube getting that big. And it still has a high surface area to volume ratio. Or, you know, think of it in terms of cooking. When you fry stuff, you're doing it because you want to brown it, right? Well, you don't throw a whole potato into a fryer, to a deep fryer. You cut it into thin slices, each of which has a much higher surface area to volume ratio because of that one dimension that's small. So there's a lot of browning surface. Okay, so that's why a cell can't get big in all 3 dimensions beyond a limit. But the organism can if it is made out of more than one cell. So this 5 by 5 by 5 unicellular organism wouldn't be possible, depending on which units, But you could have an organism the same size, the same body size, just made out of much smaller cells that take up collectively the same volume. That's what this one represents. So it's a multicellular organism, each of whose cells is now one by one by one, that has a nice 6-to-1 surface area to volume ratio. See, notice that when we had the one huge cell, the surface area to volume ratio dropped to 1.2. And that's too low. Okay. Now we go to 5. And we'll be on 5 for a little bit of time. It takes a while to get through this one slide, but then we can get through the rest of the slides more quickly. So it's, the whole chapter is not this slow. But here's another catch-all slide, in a sense. We're looking at an animal cell here. And the reason I say it's a catch-all is that not every animal cell has all of these structures. They were all just put in here to illustrate what they look like and what they do, or I'll tell you what they do. And, of course, they're not actually colored in reality, but the color coding is helpful when we look at these, so you can tell where one ends and the other begins. There's a very conspicuous organelle in here, a very large organelle, the purple thing, which is the nucleus. And I've already told you this is an animal cell, so it's not surprising there's a nucleus, right? Animals are eukarya. Our animals are members of eukarya. They're eukaryotes. So you should expect a nucleus. By the way, that's not true for every one of your cells. We and fellow mammals don't have nuclei in our red blood cells, for instance. That doesn't make us prokaryotes, and we're still eukaryotes. And the cells that create red blood cells, the stem cells that they start as, do have nuclei to begin with, but then they lose them in the course of developments, mainly because if you lose the nucleus, you can pack even more hemoglobin in a red blood cell so that it can carry oxygen and carbon dioxide even better. But without a nucleus, you don't have DNA in a eukaryotic cell, and therefore these things cannot live very long. That's why you're continuously losing billions of red blood cells and having to make billions of new ones to replace the ones that die. But anyway, this is a typical animal cell with a nucleus, and not only is a nucleus an organelle, it is more specifically a membrane-bounded organelle, which is really what eukaryotes have that differs from prokaryotes, right? Prokaryotic cells are named for the fact that they don't have a nucleus, but it's also true that prokaryotic cells don't have any membrane-bounded organelles, not just the nucleus. And most of these organelles we're about to look at are not only organelles, they're membrane-bounded organelles. So the nucleus is the first membrane-bounded organelle we'll look at, and even more specifically than that, it is one of three examples I'm going to give you that of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. The nucleus is not only membrane-bounded, it is doubly membrane-bounded. It has two membranes. Each membrane is already two layers, right? Because a membrane is a phospholipid bilayer. But the nucleus has two bilayers. So four layers of phospholipids, really. And I don't know whether you can see it from there, but if you look at it online, you'll see that there's two purple layers of membrane here. Those two membranes that cover the nucleus are called the nuclear envelope. It's a double membrane. And I've mentioned before when we first talked about the dichotomy that having membrane-bounded organelles, which only eukaryotic cells do, serves to compartmentalize eukaryotic cells. A prokaryotic cell has one compartment, the cytoplasm. A eukaryotic cell has multiple compartments because each membrane-bounded organelle is a subcompartment within the overall cell. And that is true for the nucleus, which is a membrane-bounded organelle. So the stuff inside the nucleus is not cytoplasm. It's its own compartment called the nucleoplasm. And that includes DNA, most conspicuously. I mean, I'm sure you're already aware that DNA is inside the nucleus of a eukaryotic cell. It's labeled, though, here as chromatin. And chromatin is really a mixture of molecules. Chromatin is DNA, which is nucleic acid, of course, complexed with proteins. And we'll talk more about chromatin in a different unit, but that's what it means. It is DNA, but DNA is just part of the chromatin. And also notice that inside the nucleus there is a region, the kind of darker purple region here, called the nucleolus. Be careful with that word too, because it's different from nucleus. Nucleolus is part of the nucleus. And specifically, the function of the nucleolus is to produce kinds of RNA other than messenger RNA. There's all kinds of different RNAs that we'll talk about later, but messenger RNA is what's made for the purpose eventually of producing a protein. There's other kinds of RNA that need to be made, though, and they are made using the DNA that's in the nucleolus. All right, now the surface, the nuclear envelope itself, as you can kind of see probably, is perforated. It's full of holes. Each hole is really a complex of proteins that are embedded in the membrane in kind of a circular arrangement. So the proteins are arranged to form a tunnel, a little tunnel through the nuclear envelope. And that's really important because when DNA, the genes, are used for the ultimate purpose of producing a protein, the DNA is used in transcription first, like we talked about a little bit. That produces a messenger RNA that is where the DNA is. It's inside the nucleus. But then that mRNA needs to be used in the process of translation, which is when the protein actually gets built. That's out here in the main compartment of the cell. In other words, the mRNA that's produced needs to be able to get out of the nucleus, and that's what these so-called nuclear pores are, these complexes of proteins that perforate the membrane. Another thing, and that I don't know whether you'll be able to see from where you're sitting, but hopefully the color kind of helps, although they could have used greater contrasting colors, is that the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope, it's two membranes, so there's an outer membrane. The outer membrane here and there, including right here in the picture, folds outward and is continuous with all this blue membrane. Okay, it's not separate. It just folds out and in this picture goes from purple to blue. Well, purple is officially the nucleus. The blue is officially a different organelle called the endoplasmic reticulum. And what this shows you is that the nucleus is actually continuous with the endoplasmic reticulum. It's not just that the ER, or endoplasmic reticulum, is right next to the nucleus. It actually is joined to it via membrane. And that's the next organelle we'll look at. This is another membrane-bounded organelle, but it's not multiply membrane-bounded. All of the blue here, including this kind of pancake-looking stuff, and also this tubular stuff of the same color, that's all collectively the endoplasmic reticulum. A reticulum, the word means something that is in a web-like arrangement, interconnected. But obviously there's drastically different morphology or shape to this part of the ER compared to this tubular part. And so there are two components, as you can see with the bracket here, of the endoplasmic reticulum. The two parts are called rough endoplasmic reticulum and smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Now, they're called this because under light microscopy, when you look at a cell on a slide, the part that looks like flat pancakes here looks rough through the microscope because of all these little brown dots. Those brown dots are not really part of the ER. They're connected to it. They are organelles in their own right. Those are ribosomes that we'll talk about more later. But that's what gives this part the so-called roughness. This is all rough endoplasmic reticulum. You don't see those on the surface of the tubular part, which is smooth in appearance by comparison. So this part is the smooth ER. And not only do they look different, even though they're connected and they're part of the overall same organelle, the two parts perform different functions. The smooth ER, which doesn't have the ribosomes associated with it, does multiple things, but one of the main functions is to produce lipids. This is an animal cell, so for instance, in the smooth ER, cholesterol can be built. It's an important animal lipid. Cells need to be able to do this because animal cells need cholesterol not only for the other reasons I told you, but also because cholesterol is an important component of plasma membrane. So every cell needs to be able to put that into the membrane. But another function of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum is storage of certain ions, including calcium ions, which are important in signaling mechanisms. This is really important in your muscles, for instance. Your muscles contract in part because of release of calcium from the smooth ER into the main compartment. But to keep them from continuously contracting, the cell has to sequester those calcium ions into the interior of the smooth ER. Okay, the rough ER has a totally different function, and that's why it looks rough. The roughness, as I said, is due to ribosomes. Ribosomes' job, since they are their own organelles, much tinier, but they are still organelles, the ribosomes' job is translation, which is the process of actually assembling polypeptides. So we've talked about transcription and translation. Transcription involves the DNA. The code is read in a gene, and that code is used to produce a messenger RNA, a different kind of nucleic acid, that's now holding the code for how to build a protein. And a ribosome reads that messenger RNA out in the cytoplasm to figure out how to assemble the polypeptide one amino acid at a time. That process of assembling it is called translation. Now, the reason the rough ER is studded with all of these ribosomes is that the job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum is to modify newly made polypeptides. Not all polypeptides need to be modified. Some of them, you know, they all have to be manufactured basically the same at a ribosome, hooking one amino acid at a time to the growing chain. When you're done with that, you have a polypeptide. In some cases, depending on the polypeptide, that polypeptide will fold up properly into three-dimensional shape and it doesn't need any more modification. It will just start doing its job. But some proteins, after they come off the assembly line and they're complete as a sequence of amino acids, they need to be modified one way or another. Just depends on which polypeptide it is as to what the modification could be. But the ones that need to be modified are put into the hollow interior of this rough ER. And a general word that means the hollow interior of a structure is lumen. So these new, brand new polypeptides just being built but need to be modified are strung into the lumen of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, and then the rough endoplasmic reticulum performs the modification, whatever is necessary. Now, when that modification is done, the modified protein or polypeptide is then packaged into a little parcel covered with membrane material. The membrane material that I'm talking about throughout this chapter is really all the same stuff, whether it's plasma membrane or membrane of one of these membrane-bounded organelles. It's not only the same stuff, It moves around from organelle to organelle. And this is one way. This rough endoplasmic reticulum function is one way that membrane material moves around. When the protein, which is in the lumen of the rough ER, is already modified, then the rough ER packages it by surrounding it with some of its membrane, which will then pinch off. And so you have a little bag of membrane with proteins in it that is called a vesicle. And that vesicle then will travel a short distance to this cyan-colored organelle next door, which is called either the Golgi apparatus or the Golgi complex, or sometimes just the Golgi, depending on what book you read. Golgi is just a dead Italian that it's named after. Here's where the coloring is good, because if this weren't colored a different color from blue, you might mistake this stuff for rough ER, because it's very similar. It's flattened sacs made out of membrane. It's its own organelle, though, the Golgi complex. And the Golgi complex operates more or less by analogy as a receiving and shipping center, just like at a factory or some big complex, right? You have a receiving center where the trucks come to bring things to the factory. You have a shipping center where trucks come to pick things up from the factory to take them wherever they need to go. That's what the Golgi complex does as an organelle for the cell. And so the receiving part of that job that the Golgi performs is to accept the vesicles I just talked about, the packages that are produced by the rough endoplasmic reticulum, and that house these newly modified proteins. Those get received by the Golgi complex. And then, and by the way, they receive that because vesicles, which are made out of formerly rough ER membrane, now become part of the Golgi membrane. Membrane material can fuse into other membrane material, kind of like oil droplets coalescing. And so this is how membrane material is moving around, okay? It used to be part of this organelle, now it's going to be part of this organelle. And when that vesicle fuses with the Golgi, it will empty its contents into the lumen of the Golgi. And then the Golgi figures out where this modified protein now needs to go to do its job. Some proteins get exported all the way out of the cell to operate in the extracellular fluid, for instance. Others get embedded in the plasma membrane, for instance. Well, the Golgi figures that out and then packages it in yet another vesicle made out of Golgi's membrane and sends it on its way. And you can see right here there's a vesicle that budded off of the Golgi that is going to its destination. That's why it's still cyan or teal colored, because it came from here. All right, that's the Golgi. I might as well just go clockwise so I don't forget anything. Lysosomes are listed next. Now, the some part of that means body. And what does lice mean? What is lysis?
The birth.
Right, it's splitting, like in hydrolysis. So lysosomes, the word linguistically means splitting body. But it looks just like a vesicle, right? And in fact, it is a vesicle, but it's its own organelle. A vesicle is simply a small bag made out of membrane for some reason. There's all kinds of different vesicles. But a lysosome is a vesicle. Go ahead.
How do you spell it?
The lysosome, you mean, or vesicle?
Vesicle.
Thus. A lysosome is so named because the job of a lysosome is to split apart or digest molecules in its interior. And doing that requires enzymes. Just about any chemical reaction that occurs in a cell requires an enzyme, as we'll talk much more about in Unit 3, including splitting things apart. But you already are familiar with the fact that splitting things apart chemically is hydrolysis, right? There are enzymes that are responsible for catalyzing or speeding up hydrolysis reactions, and those are therefore called hydrolytic enzymes. And there are hydrolytic enzymes inside the lysosome for good reason. Hydrolytic enzymes are dangerous things to have around because they break things apart. And the cell doesn't want the hydrolytic enzymes to break apart things that are cell structures. So it hides them or sequesters them in lysosomes so that it can then put things into the lysosome that it wants to be hydrolyzed, split apart, and that will expose it to the enzymes safely inside the lysosome, keeping it away from the rest of the cell. All right, next up is a mitochondrion, which is the singular of the word. Mitochondria is plural. And there are typically multiple mitochondria in one animal cell, although not in your red blood cells once again. Anyway, this single orange thing is one mitochondrion. Here's another one. And the mitochondrion is the second of three multiply membrane-bounded organelles we're going to discuss. The nucleus was the first. A mitochondrion also has two membranes, an outer membrane and an inner membrane. And even though we're not going to study the process yet in this unit, I'll just tell you that the main function of a mitochondrion is a complex set of reactions called cellular respiration. Cellular respiration in eukaryotic cells occurs within mitochondria. And what cellular respiration accomplishes is a drastic increase in the efficiency of ATP molecules being produced when fuel molecules are used as energy. That will make more sense when we study the particulars of it in Unit 3, but that's where it happens in a eukaryotic cell, mitochondria. Peroxisomes are also vesicle-like organelles, and to look at them, you wouldn't really be able to tell the difference between a peroxisome and a lysosome. But peroxisomes have a specialized function, which is why they got their name. Peroxisomes deal with processing peroxide-containing waste materials, basically, that occur because of the normal metabolism of a cell. Not just peroxides, but that's why they got their name. In general, they're abbreviated as ROS. Reactive oxygen species is what that means. These reactive oxygen species are oxidizing agents, meaning that they are very reactive and can easily oxidize other things, like oxidizing agents do, right? Well, that can damage materials, which is why there's such a big deal in the nutrition press nowadays about taking antioxidants. Antioxidants counteract reactive oxygen species. But we also have built-in organelles to do that job called peroxisomes. Okay, microvilli. Here's an example of something that might be on certain cells and might not be on others. It's just a catch-all picture. But this one happens to have microvilli on one end of the cell. Microvilli is a plural of microvillus, just like cactus and cacti. A villus, which there are many examples of, like there are villi on your tongue, for instance. A villus, though, is a finger-like projection. And a microvillus, therefore, is a very small villus, all it means. But you can see here in the picture that what it is really is just a outpocketing of the plasma membrane here and there. Each microvillus is one outpocketing, one finger-like projection. And can you tell just by looking at how they're formed, why they might exist, what function they could have? Well, that's a good guess, and that makes sense because they could like interlock, for instance. That would involve some proteins as well, and that would be a possibility, but that's in general not actually what's happening here. What they do is drastically increase the surface area in that region without actually adding volume, or not very much volume. Now, let me just give you a two-dimensional example here. Notice how this plasma membrane is cut. It would normally cover the whole cell, of course, but it's cut. So think of this cell as an island, and this edge of the plasma membrane, the smooth part here, as the beach. If you need to walk from here to here, for instance, along the beach, it's going to be a certain distance, right? If you keep on the beach instead of going directly. Well, if you take a distance from here to here, which is basically the same overall distance, but walk along this beach, it's going to be a much longer walk, right? There's a lot more membrane here, which means more surface area, than there is when it's smooth and doesn't have the villus. So microvilli serve to drastically increase surface area, and that's important in certain kind of cells. For instance, in your body, most of the absorption, which is in a sense the most important job of the digestive system, that's when the nutrients actually enter your body, you take them into the cells by absorption, most of that occurs in the small intestine. And the endothelium, or the inner lining of the small intestine, is full of cells that have microvilli on them. Because the job of absorbing the nutrients not only has to take place through a membrane, and the more membrane you have, the better you can do that, but it also requires proteins in the membrane to do the transporting. And the more membrane you have, the more proteins you can house to do that, which is important because you only have so much time while that food is passing through you to absorb it. Otherwise, it's going to be wasted. So we've evolved by natural selection to favor maximization of surface area via microvilli. Okay. Now, notice this all caps word, cytoskeleton, which is this, the cell skeleton is what it literally means. Cyte means cell, C-Y-T-E. That's why the names of individual cells often end in cyte, like erythrocyte for a red blood cell. The cytoskeleton is so named because it's like the skeleton of a cell, just like our skeleton is a framework within our interior. The cytoskeleton is a framework within the cell. And that is a major function of the cytoskeleton, but it has other functions as well. It's in all caps, though, and notice the colon, because the cytoskeleton as an overall structure is made out of three major kinds of proteins, which are listed here: microfilaments, intermediate filaments, and microtubules. So those three words are all really part of the cytoskeleton. And these strands of various colors that you see here are all part of the cytoskeleton. I'll talk more about those when we get a better picture for them. But notice this T-shaped thing here, which looks like two pieces of licorice at right angles. That is not the centrosome, as you might be thinking from the labeling. This T-shaped thing is made of two structures at right angles called centrioles. So the two centrioles make up the T. The centrioles, though, are in, notice this kind of yellow haze or fogginess that you see right here, this region around the T is the centrosome. In animal cells, the centrosome includes centrioles. As we'll see when we look at a plant cell in the next slide, that's not true for plants. Well, I can tell you that's true. Animal cells have centrioles in their centrosomes, whereas plant cells do not. But I can't really tell you what centrioles are for because we haven't figured that out. So that's all I'll really say, is that animal centrosomes have centrioles, other kinds of cells don't. But what about the centrosome? The centrosome is a microtubule organizing center. That's where microtubules get created and get extended from. And you can see these yellow microtubules radiating away from the centrosome. They're proteins, these microtubules, so they're polymers, and their polymers are built by adding subunits one at a time. Well, they grow from the centrosome. Centrosome is a microtubule organizing center. And as we'll look at when we study mitosis, which is part of cell division, the centrosomes are really important in mitosis. Flagellum, well, this flagellum is for the same purpose as it was on that bacterium we looked at earlier. This is another example of something you don't find on all animal cells. In fact, most of your cells do not have flagella, but what's a good example of a human cell that does have flagella? Sperm are the cells within semen. Semen is cells plus a bunch of other stuff. But yes, sperm cells are flagellated. Okay, I think I've gotten all of that. Let's then go to slide 6, which is very similar looking, except this is not an animal cell, this is a plant cell. And plant cells have just about everything that animal cells have, except they don't have cholesterol. But organelle-wise, plant cells have everything animal cells have, but they also have some things that animal cells don't. So I'm not going to go back through the things that they share with animal cells. I've already discussed those. Let's focus on the things that don't occur in animal cells. Well, one, which I've already told you about earlier, is a cell wall. The thick brown layer here is not plasma membrane. That's cell wall material, which is mostly cellulose for plants. And look how much thicker it is than the plasma membrane in orange here. And so we've already discussed the fact that that holds in pressure nicely. So it can withstand a hypotonic environment. The cell swells, but doesn't burst. While we're on the topic of the cell wall, I'll also mention plasmodesmata. This is another plural word. The singular is just plasmodesma, without the TA at the end. But a plasmodesma is a tunnel through the cell wall from one cell to the next cell. So there's cell wall between cells, right? Like different yards. And a plasmodesma is a tunnel allowing passage of just the right kind of things from one cell to the next. Notice, though, in this cutaway view, where you're seeing the tunnel cut in half, that the tunnel itself, the plasmodesma, is lined with plasma membrane material. So this is the plasma membrane of this cell, this one big cell we're looking at. But then that plasma membrane material extends through the thickness of the plasmodesma, and it will be continuous with the plasma membrane of this next cell, which means the contents of this cell, the cytoplasm of this cell, which is all the stuff outside of the other organelles but inside the cell, is really continuous with the cytoplasm of the next cell and so on, all the way through the body of the plant. We say it's made up of individual cells, but those cells are actually connected by fluid. So it's all one huge chamber, really, in a plant. But anyway, plasmodesmata allow for communication via transport of materials from one cell to the next. Okay, another non-animal organelle that plants have is a central vacuole. Pretty big in this picture. Well, the word vacuole is because it looks empty. It's not actually empty, but vacuous means empty, like a vacuum. So it's kind of a misnomer because it's not actually empty, but that's why it gets its name. A vacuole, though, is kind of like a vesicle. It's a bag of membrane. It's just much bigger than a vesicle. The central vacuole of a plant can have various functions depending on the plant and the cell. For instance, it might be where the pigment is. You know, in one of these labs that you haven't done yet, I think we look at red onion cells. And it looks like the redness of the onion is spread out over the entire layer of the onion. But when you look at it under a microscope, most of the cell is transparent, and that purpleness is only in the central vacuole. Another function, though, of a central vacuole is that it can more or less function as a garbage dump. Things that the plant does not want to have in its cytoplasm, it can put into the central vacuole and kind of forget about, keep it from interfering with the actual cytoplasmic elements. But this is another thing that's kind of interesting about central vacuoles is that it's mostly water that's in it. And plants don't have to build water, right? The more complicated molecules like proteins and stuff need to be built by the cell, whether it's whatever, not just for plants, for any kind of cell, right? But a central vacuole can be a pretty big fraction of the overall volume of a plant cell, mostly filled with stuff that it doesn't have to build, it just has to absorb from the soil, water. And this is one reason why some species of plants can increase their size very drastically compared to an animal growing. You know, like overnight, a little seedling can get very tall. It does that by adding cells, as I've talked about when we looked at the ratio earlier, has to add cells, but for a plant, a lot of the volume of that cell doesn't have to actually be built. It's just water in the central vacuole, so you can add a lot more cells more easily in a plant than in an animal, which grows slower. The other major thing that we're looking at that we didn't see in the animal cell are these green structures, which are chloroplasts. Chloro means green, by the way, but chloroplasts are the third and final example of multiply membrane-bounded organelles. So we have the nucleus, the mitochondrion, and the chloroplast, all containing more than one membrane, all enclosed by more than one membrane, which you can see in this picture, but we'll look at a close-up later. We'll study cellular respiration that happens in a mitochondrion in detail later. We'll also study the process that occurs in chloroplasts in detail later, but that process is photosynthesis. Or at least that's where photosynthesis occurs in eukaryotic cells that are photosynthetic. Photosynthesis, just roughly speaking, or basically speaking, is creation of organic molecules out of inorganic molecules. And that's done from, if we consider it as it occurs in a plant, the plant is doing that to feed itself. It makes its own food that way, but it also makes its own building block materials for other parts of the plant. And that's, by the way, that photosynthesis is something that we cannot do, which is why we absolutely rely on plants. Yeah.
Can you please repeat what you said, photosynthesis? It creates an inorganic...
No, it doesn't create inorganic. It uses inorganic materials to produce organic materials. And by the way, that process, which we'll look at later, the process of using inorganic sources to produce organic molecules is called carbon fixation. And that's something that no consumer, including us, can do. There are, ecologically speaking, there are two kinds of organisms in the world: producers and consumers. Producers can make organic material out of inorganic sources. No consumer can do that. But they need organic materials. So all consumers have to either eat other consumers, they have to either eat producers, or eat consumers that eat producers, or eat consumers that eat consumers that eat producers. We all the consumers, one way or another, rely on producers. I think that's all for the everything else we've covered, right? Yes. Okay, well, now we get to the part where we can go through the slides a little bit quicker, and the reason it's quicker, one reason is that they are really just close-ups of pictures we've already looked at. So you get a much better look in slide 7 at two organelles, shown together here because of the fact, as I said, that they are connected. You have the nucleus in purple and the endoplasmic reticulum in blue. And specifically, only the rough ER is shown here, even though it's obviously the smooth ER would be part of it as well. But you get a better view of the outpocketing that occurs right here. And this is not, it doesn't occur in just one place, it's multiple places. But the outer nuclear envelope membrane folds out and becomes the membrane of the rough ER. And it looks like the rough ER is a lot of pieces, but it's really just a lot of folds in one elaborate membrane, except for when it buds off into vesicles, which are then really not officially part of the rough ER anymore. It also gives you a closer view, this slide does, of the nuclear pores that I was talking about. You can see in magenta that each pore is really a complex of several proteins arranged kind of like the staves of a barrel with a hollow interior so that the RNA can get out, find a ribosome, and create a protein based on that code. And you also get a better view of the ribosomes themselves. The brown dots are which is what gives the rough ER its rough appearance. Each ribosome is itself an organelle, so they're really not part of the rough ER, and they're only temporarily associated with it. At any given moment, there's a lot of ribosomes, but those ribosomes are none of those is permanently attached. It's all temporary. Each ribosome is its own membrane, though, except that ribosomes, unlike these other membrane-bounded organelles we've been talking about, are not membrane-bounded. They are organelles, but they don't have their own membrane. They are much less complex than these membrane-bounded organelles, and they are really just little molecular machines whose job it is to assemble polypeptides, one amino acid at a time, under the direction of the information that's in an RNA molecule. All right. Go to 8. Well, speaking of ribosomes, we see one in detail here in brown, and this is really a lie, meaning that you would not see a complete ribosome, which is made up of two subunits, large and small. You wouldn't see both of these subunits together with nothing else attached to it. So that's why it's a lie. These two subunits only come together when the ribosome has already attached to an RNA molecule and is going to start the process of translation, which is the job of a ribosome. But the small and large subunits are modular, meaning that all small subunits are the same, all large subunits are the same for an organism, and these two happen to get together this time. But they'll be dismantled after the job of creating a protein is done, and then the next moment, the large subunit might come together with a different small subunit to form a functional ribosome. They're just all interchangeable parts. The terminology here above, free ribosome versus bound ribosome, those are not actually different structures. It's just the distinction is whether or not ribosomes are attached to a membrane. All ribosomes start out, when they come together and start their job of creating a polypeptide, all of that starts out as so-called free ribosomes, which are just in the cytoplasm. They're not attached to a membrane. And for some proteins, the complete process takes place on a free ribosome. It never does attach to a membrane. But remember, earlier I said that some polypeptides need to be modified after they're made. And the cell figures out which ones need to be modified. It starts out being built at a free ribosome, but then since it's going to be one that needs to be modified, the whole ribosome gets attached to the surface of the membrane of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. And that's how the rough ER looks rough, because it has a lot of ribosomes making new polypeptides that need to go into that rough ER so that they can be modified. And those, when they're actually tied to the membrane, they're called bound ribosomes. But when the process is complete, they're going to leave the membrane. And that's why the roughness that you see on the ER is just a snapshot. The next moment, it'll be another collection of ribosomes temporarily attached. Slide 9. Well, the only new information here is just a better look at a vesicle forming from the rough ER. This is what I've said in words before, but you can get a better picture here. This vesicle has already been completely budded off. You see another one budding, and this is what I meant by the fact that membrane material moves around from organelle to organelle, including the plasma membrane. But if a vesicle is coming from a rough ER, that means that its contents are the proteins that got modified, which is the job of the ER. And then that transport vesicle, which is shown in blue here to show you that it came from this membrane, is headed to the Golgi complex. And it's going to fuse with the membrane of the Golgi complex to spill the protein contents into the lumen of the Golgi for the next job, which you can see in 10. Now, I said that the Golgi complex is a receiving and shipping center. It does both of those jobs, but just like most factories, you don't find the receiving and the shipping center at the same place of the complex, right? The trucks that are coming in to deliver things to it go to the receiving center, usually on a different side of the building. Similarly with the cell. The receiving end of the Golgi complex, in the top in this picture, is called the cis face. And the shipping end is the other face of it, called the trans face. So cis and trans, just like in isomers, when we looked at geometric isomers before. Remember that we used cis and trans versions. Cis means same size, same side, trans means the other. It's called the cis face in this case because it's the same side that faces the Golgi complex. Remember in the overall picture, it was right next door to the Golgi. It was right next door to the ER. The ER was blue, then the Golgi was teal colored. Well, it's the cis face that's right up against the ER. And the trans face is closer to the plasma membrane. And the trans face is where new vesicles made out of Golgi membrane are created, now containing the already modified protein to be sent to its proper destination, whether that's out of the cell or into the plasma membrane. Eleven. Well, we have some more vesicles at work here. On the left, we have a process called phagocytosis. Think back to this last lab you had, when I started the lecture telling you that there are three major categories of processes that can move things into or out of cells: active transport, passive transport, and vesicular transport. Vesicular transport just means transport via a vesicle. So a vesicle is used to get something either into or out of the cell. And there are different kinds. Vesicular transport is the general term. Whenever there is a vesicle used, it's vesicular transport. But there is multiple kinds of vesicular transport. Depending first on the direction of transport. You can have vesicular transport to bring something in or vesicular transport to export something. If it's coming in, then that particular type of vesicular transport is called endocytosis. Osis means condition, cyte means cell, and endo means in. If you do the same process but in reverse and use a vesicle to move something out of the cell, then it's exocytosis. And then we can further subdivide endocytosis. All endocytosis moves it in. But depending on what gets moved in, it can be classified as either phagocytosis, which we're looking at here in A, or pinocytosis, P-I-N-O instead of P-H-A-G-O. Well, the distinction here is whether it is a large solid chunk, large from the cell's point of view, which is what phagocytosis is named for. It literally means cell eating. So just like you eat more or less solid chunks, that's what phagocytosis brings in via a vesicle. But you can also use a vesicle to bring in just a little sip of the liquid exterior, in which case it's more like drinking, and that's what pinocytosis means, cell drinking. They are both, though, endocytosis because they bring something in via a vesicle. And also, I think I mentioned in downstairs that compared to the other two, compared to active and passive transport, vesicular transport is unusual because whatever gets transported into or out of the cell doesn't actually pass through any membrane. You can see here now why that's true. This chunk is outside of the cell, but if the plasma membrane gets deformed and wraps around this chunk, which has happened here, this is the same chunk, and then seals off at the other end, now you have a little vesicle that has that chunk, and that chunk is now officially inside the cell, but it didn't go through any membrane. You see what I'm saying there? So it's a kind of a cheating mechanism. But the reason that's done here in this case is to bring this thing in and break it down, to digest it, in other words. And just like I was talking about before, digestive enzymes, hydrolytic enzymes, are dangerous things to have around, so they're in their own little safe lysosomes. Lysosome is made out of the same membrane material, though, as this food vacuole that forms from the plasma membrane material. And therefore, they can fuse together easily and mix their contents. And now you have the digestive enzymes necessary to break down this brown stuff safely away from the rest of the cell. And then all you have to do is break open the vacuole and let it out. Now, there's a similar thing happening on the right, but notice this is called autophagy. Auto means self. And this is the same P-H-A-G as in phagocytosis, which means eat. So autophagy means self-eating. And the reason it's called that is because the cell is doing the same process as in the left, except what it's eating, so to speak, or what it's digesting, is not something that it brought in from the environment, but something that was already in the cell. It's eating part of itself. This mitochondrion, in this example, has seen better days. It's done its job, it's worn out, but it's not total trash. It's made of valuable subunits that can be rearranged by the cell to do other things. So it's worth recycling it, basically, by digesting it safely away from the rest of the cell, just like in phagocytosis, but it didn't come in from the environment. Twelve is just a better view of the central vacuole, and it gives you even better appreciation of just how much volume, because this is a true photograph down here, not a cartoon, just how much volume the central vacuole can take up in the volume of a cell, which is what I was saying, why they can grow so quickly compared to animals. They don't have to create that stuff. 13 is yet more cartoon versions of this movement of membrane material around. So we've already talked about the vesicles that bud off the ER. They then fuse with the Golgi, and now it's officially part of the Golgi, that membrane. But then the Golgi will make new vesicles that used to be its membrane, and that vesicle will fuse with the plasma membrane and become now part of the plasma membrane. There's a continuous turnover of membrane material, which is why some books refer to all of this membrane stuff as the endomembrane system. At any given moment, each piece is part of one organelle or another, but it all gets shared. It all gets moved around continuously. Fourteen, close-up of the mitochondrion, or a mitochondrion. This is multiply membrane-bounded, as we already talked about. There are two membranes, which are descriptively called the outer membrane and the inner membrane. But notice that the outer membrane is actually smaller than the inner membrane, because the outer membrane is really just a smooth covering, only as big as it has to be. The inner membrane, on the other hand, is highly folded, so it includes a lot more material, has a lot more surface area. These folds accomplish that, just like microvilli do. They increase surface area, so do these folds in the interior, in the inner membrane. And each fold, by the way, has its own name, which is crista, the plural of which is Christi. They are there for the same purpose, to increase the amount of membrane, increase the surface area. The reason that's important is that the details of cellular respiration that we're going to learn in Unit 3 require a bunch of proteins embedded in membranes. Therefore, the more membrane you have, the more proteins you can house in there, and the more efficient the organelle can be at conducting the whole process of cellular respiration. Just as membrane-bounded organelles compartmentalize a cell, a multiply membrane-bounded organelle is itself compartmentalized. So the mitochondrion is already a separate compartment compared to the cytoplasm, is what I mean. But since the mitochondrion has two membranes, there are two different compartments just within the mitochondrion, and they get separate names. There's one compartment that's between the two membranes, and that's why it's called the intermembrane space. Literally, between membranes is what intermembrane means. But the space, the other compartment that is fully inside the inner membrane, is called the mitochondrial matrix. And that's important in cellular respiration that we'll talk about later. The two compartments, by the way, I mean the fluids occupying those two compartments are different from each other. So it's not just that they're compartmentalized, they're actually different kinds of fluids. How am I looking? Almost out. So, yeah, we'll stop there. Look at 15 next time.